Hi, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of the show today, we are going to be talking with Samara Frame, who's the actress in a production of My Name is Rachel Corrie, and I saw the play recently, and it is an extremely important play, so we'll be talking with Samara Frame about that. Before Samara, we'll be talking with Bob Perry about his article, Who Are These People? Taking a look at the people in the mass media who worked to create public support for war crimes in Iraq following 9/11, the impact they had then, and what they're still covering up today. And opening the show up, I'm very happy to welcome to the show for the first time Maximilian Forte. Max wrote an article called A Victory for the Libyan People, the Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya. And Max is, he's an interesting cat. He's an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada. And his website is openanthropology.org. And we'll talk a little bit more about that towards the end of the interview. But I was really just driven to have Max on the show when I read his article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya. So, Max, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. You know, what was it? You wrote this article that's a really thorough and very compelling and enraging article, actually. Not the article itself, but what you've actually pointed to. If you read this article and you don't get mad, there's something wrong with you. Or your lips are so quick sealed to the posteriors of the imperialists that you just can't think right. You know, that's a problem. So what drove you to write this article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya?
Well, the main problem that I began with, months back when the protests in Libya first began, I was frankly quite open and sympathetic to the fact that there could have been a grassroots popular protest against an authoritarian regime, and that these people would possibly offer Libya something much better. I had no idea of what was coming next. I began to suspect something was up when NATO began to hold deliberations about getting involved. And this suddenly seemed to take a very different turn from the other so-called revolutions in the Middle East and North Africa. And the justifications that NATO began to use to justify, to rationalize its involvement and to possibly take over the situation from what were then called protesters, later called rebels, and so on. And I was interested in seeing what kinds of arguments they would be using and what kinds of arguments their Libyan partners would use to justify such a extremely serious step as military intervention. And, in fact, rerouting the revolution through foreign military intervention. So then that is what started me off.
Yeah, and that's actually, it's extremely important because these aren't just things that sort of cropped up on their own. This is actually, these myths that you've listed they have been voiced and fought for and popularized by NATO, by European leaders, by Obama, by the mainstream media, and even, as you point out, the International Criminal Court, which is really a stunning roster of very bad organizations and people in the world, huh?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and they've latched onto some very powerful myths that were bound to, at least to some extent, generate greater popular support among public opinion in the West for the need for involvement, the need for intervention. And that was certainly true, at least in the early weeks of the intervention. Then support dropped off, and actually attention dropped off as well. But you're right, and the International Criminal Court in particular has, I think, done itself a great deal of damage as a result of some of the statements it's made about Libya, some of the very, very careless statements that showed that it was more of a partisan in the war than of a neutral arbiter that was interested, you know, in prosecuting all human rights abuses. It isn't. It's not interested in prosecuting human rights abuses. It's interested in prosecuting the abuses of the Gaddafi regime. The abuses that have been committed by the rebels, they're not even up for discussion at the ICC. So when you have a court, a so-called court, operating in that manner, you can't take it seriously anymore. And in fact, virtually the entire African continent has dismissed it. It has ignored its call for an arrest warrant on Muammar Gaddafi. It says it's not going to, the African Union is not going to respect that warrant.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking with Max Forte, an associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Concordia University in Montreal, and we're talking about his article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya. Max, let me ask you this, you know, because when you're telling the story, I keep thinking, okay, well, there's a very important lesson just by itself to learn, which is that imperialism is a world system. And the way the world functions, by and large, these international institutions are products created to a large extent to actually organize and administer the world in the interests of imperialists. And quite frankly, it seems like that's what these things are doing. It's especially evident now in the case of Libya. You know, you talked about these 10 myths, and you said that they're, again, the importance of these myths lie in their wide reproduction with little question and to deadly effect. And I want to talk to you about a couple of them in particular, but I want to hear from you what you think is actually the most dangerous myth.
Well, the most dangerous myth is the biggest one of them all, and that is that you can have a humanitarian military intervention. That, I think, is also the deadliest one. And, I mean, you talk about the kind of Orwellian language that we're getting into here, the idea that you can engage in war to save lives. I think maybe 10 or 20 years ago, you wouldn't have heard such, if you pardon me for saying, such illogical obscenities being voiced. Something, I think, has happened to either the general public or to the leadership of that public that feels greater confidence in making such assertions, that you can engage in war to save lives. And I'm certain that the NATO intervention did save the lives of particular individuals. It also helped to lengthen and escalate and broaden the war so that many more people have been killed than would have likely been the case had NATO not gotten involved. And this is a case in almost every situation, it is a case in every situation where NATO has been involved. NATO is not in the business of saving lives. Militaries don't save lives. That's not what they're trained to do. As much as people would like to protest and see militaries as being sort of angelic figures and so forth, that's not what they do. And so that is, I think, the most dangerous myth of them all.
Well, let's pursue that a little bit. We're talking with Max Forte, the author of the article, A Victory for the Libyan People, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya. This has been a major argument, and it's been a major argument for many, many years. I mean, there's been these times where the U.S. imperialists have intervened, where NATO's intervened in different places around the world. And it's always been something that has caused a tremendous amount of dislocation and stumbling on the part of people who are generally progressive, generally opposed to imperialist invasions and interventions around the world. But you tack the title humanitarian intervention onto it, and then suddenly all kinds of confusion gets unleashed. And particularly, I think you know, as you said, look, Gaddafi, we can talk about, you know, the one myth that you talk about there about Gaddafi being demonized or being a demon. And, you know, as you say, and I think I agree with this, is that Gaddafi was not, you know, he's hardly the demon that they portray. On the other hand, he's pretty bad in terms of what was going on. And there was actually probably an element of popular content to the uprising in the beginning. But this thing of these people coming in and immediately just sort of hijacking it in a way and really maneuvering to have it serve their interests. I mean, even the reports that they talked about, the CIA teams on the ground, the British intelligence on the ground, all of these things going on, the use of the, you know, the rebels themselves saying, well, we could have never done anything if it hadn't been for the constant pummeling given to the Gaddafi forces and to whole cities by the various imperialist air forces. You know, to me, there's actually something that you get into here, too, which is it's not just humanitarian. It actually casts it in something that's even more insidious, I think, the responsibility to protect. And that's something that has raised all kinds of debate, which I think is good to have, but we really got to get a lot sharper on this. And there's so much that we could pick apart around that. It's just we could take the rest of the show doing it. But I want to ask you what you think about this responsibility to protect cover.
Yes, well, in a way, it's a sort of renewal and revival of old missionizing sort of ethos that was popular to some extent anyway in Europe and North America during the colonial period. The idea that it is our unique burden, you know, it used to be called the white man's burden, to save the natives from themselves because the natives are mired in savagery and superstition, ignorance and violence. And in fact, you can almost never hear a reference to any war in Africa without it being qualified as a tribal war because supposedly those are the bad wars, you know, not like the ones that we fight. Either a tribal war or genocide. You would think that Africa has some unique, perhaps genetic monopoly on tribalism and genocide. So to some extent, responsibility to protect, well, to a great extent, I think it's a revival of that kind of thinking and a renewal and a fortification of it. But you're right. You mentioned at one point that when, as soon as you start talking about humanitarian intervention, all kinds of division, doubt, and confusion begins to occupy people among what is referred to as the left politically. And this was the case also in Libya too, where the argument was, we need to save Benghazi. If we don't intervene, people in Benghazi will be massacred. No evidence on the ground to support that suggestion. Worse yet is that now that the tables have been turned and we're dealing with three Gaddafi strongholds, at least three, Sirte, Sabah, and Bani Walid, all three under siege by the new regime, all three being pummeled by foreign air force. Nobody is standing up and saying, look, we have to save these cities. We have to protect these civilians. This isn't just. They're being denied food, water, electricity. They're being subjected to violence. We have already documentation of revenge killings by the rebels, in some cases such complete ethnic cleansing that they've depopulated at least an entire town next to Misrata. So in this case, we actually do have evidence to support the suggestion that, you know, there could be massacres in each of these places. Suddenly, all the so-called left people who were very much in support of protecting civilians, humanitarian intervention, you don't hear them. And I find this kind of thing, personally speaking, I find it kind of outrageous, because it is definitely a case of selective attention and of selective morality. And when you have selective morality, you don't have morality.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Maximilian Forte. Max is the author of A Victory for the Libyan People, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya.
Well, let me ask you this, because I think it's really important what you're saying. And you know, one of the things that comes up, I think, all the time, and, you know, and actually Richard Falk made this point in a piece he wrote on this, where he said, you know, if there was any legitimacy to this idea of responsibility to protect and humanitarian intervention, one would think that there were many places in the world that could have been intervened in with a more legitimate reasoning around this, or legitimacy to that reasoning. And he points to, if there was ever a place you were going to intervene to protect civilians and to in a humanitarian intervention, one might look first to Gaza and what the Zionist regime is doing in Gaza.
That's absolutely right. There are many cases, but it's also the way that human rights is being reconstructed by dominant Western nations, that human rights is being reconstructed to mean exclusively civil liberties. So when a state denies its people certain civil liberties, then we have a potential case for intervention. But human rights, at least, you know, when the United Nations was first established, it had a sort of broader meaning than that. It included also what we would call social and economic rights. In other words, the kinds of rights that are routinely being denied to citizens in North America every day when they lose their jobs, when they lose their homes, when they go hungry, those sorts of rights. We don't talk about intervention to protect civilians from that kind of abuse of their rights, which are supposed to be inalienable. These are also rights to life. I mean, if you understand the implications of what going without food are. So it's a very selective interpretation of human rights that's being imposed, and that's being imposed with a success, I would think, that it hasn't had any time before. So this is also something that's relatively novel about the current situation.
Now, well, let's talk about something that's flowing from that. You know, one of the things that you point out is one of the myths is that, you know, most of the pro-Gaddafi forces in Libya are African mercenaries. And you actually argue that all this concentration on African mercenaries is actually a cover for what in fact is happening is ethnic cleansing.
Yes. You know, this is one of the most atrocious things about what people refer to as the Libyan Revolution. And it is not just me who's saying this. There are all kinds of, you know, the kinds of organizations that even in some cases, backed intervention, such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Reporters for the Los Angeles Times were among the first, I have to say, to expose some of these crimes. And they've been persistent and enduring, and they've begun really since day one. And it serves a number of purposes. One, it serves to create, to bolster another myth that Gaddafi has no popular support. Therefore, how is he able to conduct this repression? Who are the forces? How is he able to maintain himself in power for so long? Well, foreigners. What kind of foreigners? Black ones. Sub-Saharan Africans. What are they doing? Well, they're paid mercenaries. How are they getting in? They're getting in through the airports. Therefore, we need a no-fly zone. And so, in a sense, the argument for a no-fly zone is rooted in a kind of racial hysteria. And it was racial hysteria. I followed these things actively in various social media, especially in Twitter, where the arguments were they're coming for our wives. They're going to rape our women. Which is a classic kind of expression of fear against the black male, that they're coming to take our women. And you find, in fact, even some journalists, people who I think are respected by the mainstream media, people in Al Jazeera, one who was repeating an absolute lie, which is that plane loads of mercenaries were landing from Zimbabwe. That journalist was Dima Khatib, who's the Latin America bureau chief for Al Jazeera. You had people such as Mona El-Tahawi, who's appeared on CNN, on Democracy Now! For that matter, who also repeated these assertions, unfounded assertions, about African mercenaries coming in to slaughter people. Never, by the way, never substantiated. Human Rights Watch went as far as saying that in eastern Libya, where all these alleged crimes by mercenaries were taking place, they found no evidence whatsoever that there were ever any mercenaries at all. So, I mean, it's stunning. And it's being used, and it's still being used, to round up Africans, to abduct them off the street, to beat them, torture them, rape them, rob them, and that there have been mass killings as well. Now, all of the people who are talking about protecting civilians and the responsibility to protect, and we can't let, you know, we can't stand idly by. We're Americans. We're different, is what Obama asserted. Where are those voices now? If they had spoken out now, you know, I might have been willing to treat them with a bit more respect and say, you know, well, they're credible. They're even-handed, at least. They may be busybodies, but at least they're even-handed. But they're busybodies, and they're not even-handed. So I don't think anyone here had any interest in saving the lives of innocent civilians. I think everybody was quite willing and is quite willing to stand idly by and watch massacres happen. People ask, how can you do that? Well, you're doing it, and you're doing it right now.
And on that note, Max, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks. It was my pleasure.
And let me tell people again, your website is openanthropology.org. And people could find this article on that website?
Yes, they will.
And I'm telling you, if you think that what was happening in Libya is a victory for the people, you need to go to this website and check out this article, The Top 10 Myths in the War Against Libya by Max Forte. And his website is openanthropology.org. Again, Max, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Have a good day.
Thanks, you too. Bye now. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com about the cover-ups around Iraq and what's happening, continuing to happen today. So stay tuned.
You got to lie to me, baby. Lie to me, baby, move on.
right. That was Lie to Me from Tom Waits. Boy, quite a fitting musical introduction to this segment of the show. Bob Perry recently wrote an article talking about he introduced it this way. He said, when President George W. Bush took aim at Iraq in 2002-2003, it was the smart career play in the U.S. news media to jump on the pro-war bandwagon and cheer on propaganda about weapons of mass destruction and other excuses for war. Belatedly, the New York Times' Bill Keller admits that mistakes were made. Well, Bob has written an article that examines who the hell are these people, and he takes a look at the people in the mass media who worked to create public support for war crimes in Iraq following 9/11, the impact they had then, and what the hell they're still covering up today. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this. That Keller piece really was a remarkable piece of I don't know what, man. It was striking for a number of reasons. And I'd ask you first, what made you feel compelled to respond to that particular comment or memorializing of 9/11 and what happened afterwards?
Well, as you know, Bill Keller was executive editor of the New York Times, which is possibly arguably the top job in American journalism. So he wasn't a nobody. He wasn't just some schmo, a talking head on TV. And remarkably, after 9/11, he was writing opinion columns, essentially, for the New York Times Magazine. He had lost out, actually, for the power struggle job for executive editor with Hal Raines. But then Raines ran afoul of a scandal, Jason Blair fiasco. And so the New York Times got rid of him, and they turned to Keller. Now, they turned to him after the Iraq War had started. And Keller, when he was writing his columns, began writing about in support of invading Iraq. He developed something, a group he sort of called the I Can't Believe I'm a Hawk Club. And in that were all these essentially liberal columnists, Tommy Friedman, Fareed Zakaria, Richard Cohen, you know, a number of these people, highly esteemed pundits, supposedly. And they were part of this club that Keller wrote about, where they had supported the war. And he explained, this is before the war, the invasion, why he did so. Then, of course, the main arguments, the WMD, failed to materialize. But even after Keller's articles about why we should go to war had been essentially disproved, and there was egg all over their faces, really, the New York Times makes him executive editor, one of the top jobs in American journalism. So Keller feels he can't really talk about all his thoughts until after he leaves the job, and he's just retired from that position, is now back with the New York Times Sunday Magazine doing opinion pieces. So he did an article sort of explaining why he had jumped on the bandwagon for war, and explaining that part of it was his feelings about 9/11, and that he felt that a more muscular response was needed than just going after Al Qaeda and occupying Afghanistan, that Iraq was something that had to be done. He explained how much he bought into all these falsehoods about WMD. And so he provides this explanation. It's kind of hand-wringing. He does acknowledge in the piece that just appeared last week that the invasion of Iraq has turned out to be a monumental blunder in his view. But he kind of writes sort of all these excuses for him and his friends as to why what they did wasn't really all that bad in terms of providing propaganda support for George W. Bush in conducting the invasion. So I just thought it was important to respond to that. And the main point I wanted to make, and what was so shocking to me about this article, was that there's not a single reference in this fairly lengthy piece to international law and the principles that were set down by the Nuremberg tribunals after World War II, that aggressive war was the supreme international crime, and that a key purpose for the United Nations being formed after World War II was to prevent a recurrence of these aggressive wars. And the point about aggressive war, as Justice Robert Jackson explained, is that it was a supreme international crime because within it is the accumulated evil of the whole. In other words, that by having aggressive war, you unpack all the evils related to war, all the kinds of depredations that are brought upon humankind. And here's the New York Times former executive editor writing this long apologia, in a sense, for why he was a supporter of this conflict without a single reference to these fundamental principles that are supposed to guide civilized behavior in the modern world. So I thought it was kind of a remarkable omission and one that needed to be responded to. Plus, I also felt the sort of the self-serving explanations that he offered reflected something quite troubling, that personal feelings of these important pundits was supposedly more important in many ways than not only the principles of international law, but the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who have died and suffered miserably because of the U.S. invasion, which was unprovoked and we now know was under false pretenses.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. And Robert is the guy who broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 1980s for Associated Press and Newsweek. And we're talking about his article, Who Are These People?, about the big-name pundits in U.S. journalism and what they covered up and fostered in relation to the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq. And later we're going to get into a little bit what they're continuing to do today. Now, you know, Bob, one of the things that really struck me is when you're talking about this international law, you know, there is in Nuremberg, there was a whole series of things that went on in Nuremberg that not just the people who propagated, who were directly hands on the trigger, you know, whatever, turning the switches, those people making the laws themselves, those people were held responsible for their actions. But it also went and said that, look, the propagandists in the regime were actually responsible for that, for what happened. And you think about this, what was unleashed in this, and it would have been a lot more difficult to unleash it without the kind of public opinion that was created by these various pundits who went out and talked about it. And I remember very clearly all the people who talked about, well, I've suddenly changed. I found myself, even Keller's thing about the birth of my daughter 9 months after 9/11 made me understand that we had to go to war. This is the kind of thing. These people actively promoted a program that, like you said, it resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands, and some people say a million or more people in Iraq. And what it unleashed, what continued to support in Afghanistan and other places, is just incredible to me. And these people have to be held responsible. And it's very, very worrisome, this question of they walk around like they have no responsibility at all.
Well, there's also a self-absorption that was throughout this piece, and that's why I titled it, Who Are These People? This idea that their thinkings, their feelings, whether it's because, oh, I felt I had to protect my daughter born, as he put it, exactly 9 months after 9/11, whatever that's supposed to mean, that is somehow takes precedence over the real life and death horrors of, you know, that occurred in Iraq. And as I in the piece, I went back and described some of the incidents that occurred very early in the conflict during the shock and awe phase when, with the cheers of these pundits and ringing in George Bush's ears, he authorizes these attacks on essentially civilian targets. There was one restaurant where they thought Saddam Hussein might be having dinner, so they blew it up. They bombed it, and Saddam wasn't there, but they killed about 20 people who were having dinner there, including children. And the torso of one of these young women was pulled out, and then her head separately, as her mother, who survived, stood there screaming. There was a case, if you remember, there was that 12-year-old boy who was a victim of one of the American bombings. His father, his mother, his siblings were all killed in the bombing. His arms were blown off. And there's sort of a great show of how Americans care so much about these injured Iraqis. There was a lot of publicity about the U.S. taking him off to Kuwait to have prosthetic arms put on him. And he, as he was leaving, he said, I'd rather die than live without my arms. And also without his family, one might say. So while Keller and these others have this sort of hand-wringing, oh, we thought we were doing the right thing, and oh, we felt so vulnerable after 9/11, it is so out of touch. I mean, the comparison is so shocking to what actually occurred in Iraq. And beyond that, there is a reason why the people after World War II set down these rules. It wasn't just that they were kind of making stuff up for the fun of it. They had just lived through cases of horror that it's hard to imagine, and they said, we don't want to have this repeated, so here are the rules. And the UN was set up, and there were procedures set up, that if in certain events, certain situations, you can get the permission to invade. If say, you know, genocide is being conducted or something like that, you can be allowed to go in. It was even, I think, rather arm-twisted kind of situation. But with Libya, that was the argument that was used to save lives, to protect civilians. Granted, it turned out to be kind of a fraudulent reason, but that was the reason. In Iraq, that wasn't the case. And we now know, I was actually just did a piece on Cheney's memoir, and not that there's much in Cheney's memoir that's worth much, but there's one interesting admission where he describes how Bush did go back to the UN for a second resolution. that there was this, that Bush recognized, and Tony Blair and Great Britain recognized, they needed a second resolution to authorize the actual invasion. So Bush goes to the Security Council, but he's unable to get many votes for it. He's rebuffed. So he pulls the draft resolution off the floor. And that's this, and that night, as Cheney describes, he makes that dramatic demand that Hussein must leave within 48 hours. And the American press focused entirely on the deadline. They did not focus on the fact that the U.S. had been repudiated on his desire to have the Security Council authorize the invasion. So then Bush pretended that this earlier resolution, 1441, gave him permission to do it. It didn't, and he knew it didn't. He was lying again. But in the midst of all this, you have people like Keller who failed as journalists, failed miserably to do their jobs, which include trying to supposedly help the American people understand these things in realistic ways, presenting evidence and facts. Instead, the major news organizations of the United States, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, you can go down the whole list, they acted as conveyor belts for propaganda. There was a point after the invasion began that not only did Fox News do these kind of montages of American heroic scenes as with background music, the battle hymn of the Republic, but MSNBC was doing the same thing. They had their own montages with heroic titles, Home of the Brave, and you know they showed a little boy, you know, with yellow ribbons for his dad who was bringing freedom to Iraq. The U.S. news media behaved in no different a way than what you started off this question about, that there were the Nazi propagandists who created an environment for the kinds of atrocities we saw then. Similarly, and in a more recent example, in Rwanda, for instance, some of the radio talk show people there who were whipping up the racial hatreds, the ethnic hatreds that led to the massacres that were in Rwanda, they've been hauled off to the International Criminal Court. But none of these folks, because it's the United States did it, not only do Bush and Cheney feel they can essentially admit to all this stuff with no fear of being punished, even admit to authorizing waterboarding, which we've always regarded as torture, without any fear of being punished, but the pundits and the journalists who helped create the environment for these things to happen, they have no fear about being punished. They don't even fear losing their careers. They don't fear getting fired. And I also point out a case, I've known many journalists, good journalists, who have suffered horribly for just being accused of not being entirely precise in some story they did. Take Gary Webb, for example, the brave journalist who revived the story about the Contra drug trafficking for the San Jose Mercury News and paid a horrible price. He was attacked because he was supposedly not perfect in how he rendered the story. He was driven out of journalism. He was unable to find work and ultimately committed suicide. And that's a guy who actually brought something forward that was important to the American people to know about. It was also true, by the way, the CIA ultimately did a report because of Webb's efforts, and the CIA Inspector General said, yes, the Contras were deeply involved in drug trafficking, and we knew it, and we protected it. That's what they concluded. So that's what happens to you if you stand against the establishment and do it honestly. Now, if you're Bill Keller and Fareed Zakaria and Richard Cohen and Christopher Hitchens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all these liberal war hawks, nothing happens to you. Your careers go on wonderfully, thank you. Tommy Friedman's got a new bestseller out. They're all making tons of money hand over fist, pretty much, and they don't expect anything else. Mm-hmm. It's this upside-down system that we've now developed.
Let me come in here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Robert Perry, a journalist and author whose work can be found on the ConsortiumNews.com site. We're talking about the complicity of the major American pundits in war crimes committed when the U.S. invaded Iraq. Now, Bob, we have about 4 minutes left, and I wanted to get to this question. One of the things I was thinking about was the impact of all this that happened, and in particular, the point I think you started to talk to about Gary Webb, and frankly yourself, that you know you were actually somewhat punished for the things that you did. I remember when we first met years ago, you were telling stories about you know what had happened to you for the work you did in revealing this you know the Iran-Contra stories, and you know you look at Keller recently. I actually, interestingly enough, his hatchet job on Julian Assange was actually you know, you're looking at that again. You're thinking, what the hell? And the question I have is because we look at this stuff stuff around Libya today and other things. You know, and you have a series of articles, and I really want – we're not going to get a chance to talk much about it, but I really want to refer people to them, a series of articles on Libya, and I think really exposing the kind of distortions that have been coming up in the press, including, you know, the assumed guilt of Gaddafi and Libya in the Pan Am 103 Lockerbie bombing, no matter what – how many questions are raised, and the makeup of the rebel forces. The fact that what we're seeing coming out in the news today, belatedly, is that there's actually a lot of Islamic fundamentalists involved up in there. What is the impact to have this kind of abandonment of truth-telling and seeing creating biased public opinion as the role of journalism? What's the impact of that in the world today?
Well, I think it's contributed to a dysfunctional American political system. You know, overall, I would say, I know people focus on different parts of this beast that we have causing all this chaos for the United States and the world. But essentially, how much you can isolate is one thing. I think it's a system-wide failure that relates a lot to how much money you can make if you play ball and how much money you don't make if you don't play ball. And this is true in politics. If you go against some powerful interests, you don't get the donations. The lobbyists don't like you. But that same sort of pattern applies to journalism, that if you play ball, you get stories handed to you on a platter. Your editors think you're great. You get patted on the head. You might get a nice gig on one of the TV shows, which might pay you as much as you get for doing your work as a journalist. So there's a lot of money to be made. But the consequence of all this very bad journalism that we've seen over the past, at least the last few decades, is that the American people don't have a clue what's going on in terms of the world. They're filled with false notions. And a lot of this does go back to the post-Vietnam period. There was a little window there where the Washington Press Corps was doing its job much better. People were much better informed. There was real skepticism about the whole role of the American empire. That, you know, Vietnam was seen as a vast overreach of American power, and that became something that was being criticized and examined. You get to the 1980s, and under Ronald Reagan, there's a reversal of that. Suddenly, you're not allowed to look critically at what the U.S. government is doing. If you try it as a journalist, you're deemed liberal. You're essentially marginalized. People lose jobs. The Gary Webb case is sort of repeated in various ways over and over again. So what you end up with is an American public that is, first of all, extremely distrustful, but also very confused and doesn't have the kind of hard facts and serious information to function in a democratic way in regards to. So I think overall that's what you're contributing to. It's not entirely the press, but the press is a significant factor.
And on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up. And Bob, thank you very much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
And talk to you again soon. We've been talking with Robert Perry from ConsortiumNews.com. And for those of you who remember, he broke many of the Iran-Contra stories in the 1980s for Associated Press and Newsweek. And he continues his work. Go to ConsortiumNews.com. Check out his work there, including most recently his work, or over the past six months or so, his work on Libya. You'll learn a lot that you'll slap your head and say, I just didn't know that. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Samara Frame. And we'll be talking about the play My Name is Rachel Corey, so stay tuned.
Conspiracy theories abound. I want to make it clear to people that, you know.
You heard of Rachel Corey. The press won't tell her story. Caught between
All right, welcome back. And that's Rachel Corey by 10-Foot Pole. All right? And joining us now to talk about a play that My Name is Rachel Corey, which a lot of you know about, but not too many have seen because it's very hard to get this play produced in this country. Let me start off with a little background information about the play and the controversies surrounding it. Rachel Corey came from America. She was a young woman who was killed while defending a Palestinian home in Gaza against the attempts of the Israeli army to destroy it with a bulldozer. Rachel's courage and sacrifice are celebrated by the Palestinian people and attacked by the Zionist government. When this play was first scheduled to be produced in the U.S., the pro-Israeli machine forced its cancellation. Although it's been produced in a few places across the country since then, the theaters brave enough to produce it often find themselves in the middle of a fierce campaign against the play by pro-Israel forces. And joining us now to talk about the play is Samara Frame, who gives, frankly, an extremely powerful, very moving performance as Rachel Corey. Like, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, this was a new experience for you.
Yeah, it sure was. This is the first time that I've done a play that was so controversial, that had so much weight around, so much business around it. So it was really interesting to try to extract the production of the play from all of the sort of the hurricane that was swirling around. I think we did a very good job, and I had a lot of support of people at the Theatricum, Alan Gear and Susan Angelo, the director, and Alan Blumenfeld, who helped to kind of cushion me from that, and they took care of a lot of the outreach and that kind of thing, and I was able to focus really on the actual production and sort of finding Rachel Corey and her voice. But it's been wild. It's been so great.
Why don't you tell people just briefly a little bit about who Rachel Corey is and what the play is?
So Rachel Corey was a peace activist from Olympia, Washington. She was 23 when she died. She was called to activism from a very young age. In fact, at the end of the play, there's a video clip of her in fifth grade talking about her call to activism. So she was invited to Gaza by a contact, a friend of hers. So she went over and really she joined the International Solidarity Movement. And I think in her perspective, it was her purpose for going there was to reach out to human beings who were suffering. I think that was her big call. She talks a lot about sort of the American white person privilege and wanting to do something with that and not just rest on the laurels of what she was born with, really. So she went over there and she stood, they held banners and they organized peace protests and they acted as pure witnesses to events through press releases and such. And in 2003, she was killed by a bulldozer while she was trying to prevent the demolition of a civilian person's home. And so she passed away, and she has since, her story has since become this event in and of itself. And the thing that I think makes her story really unique is that she was an avid journalist. So she kept all these diaries and journals and emails and letters, and she was a poet and an artist. And so we were able, Alan Rickman and Catherine Viner took that information and compiled it into this play. Yeah.
Well, it's incredibly, I mean, look, her writing is, and this is one of the things I wanted to ask you because, you know, her writing is just so powerful. And
yeah.
It's so, and you do a great job of bringing her alive from the opening scene to the end. You do a great job of really giving the audience a sense of who is this woman, what motivated her, and how she developed in the course of this. Because, you know, her mom talks about, you know, and I know part of the thing of trying to cushion the struggle around this is like people are saying, well, she really didn't know what she was doing.
Right.
Bull. She didn't. She knew what she was doing.
She knew.
And, you know, she got in there and she saw injustice and she felt she mustered up the courage to say, I can't stand this. And so many of the passages from her journals and from her emails and the discussions she's having with her mom about, look, when you see what's going on, you can't not act. You have to act.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be stopped. And her mother talks about being sent to websites and getting books. Told, I got to go to the library and get tons of books to
right,
read.
Right.
You know, and it's to me, it was like really, and you brought that to life, I thought, in a very, very, very good way.
Thank you. You know, her with all of the, like you're talking about her letters to her mom and all this kind of thing. I think you're right. I think she was with her mom, for example. They had this dialogue and they had these conversations. And even if it's just one person, her mom started to read and started to investigate and learned more and more about these people. And yeah, she was very, a lot of people have bandied about the word naive. And I personally don't think she was naive. I think that she had a lot of learning to do and she knew that she didn't have the whole picture, but she was 23 and she was learning as much. She was soaking it all in. And I think that she wanted to go there and see so that she wouldn't be another American who was reading about it in the papers with no sense of context and no sense of who are these human beings who are suffering, you know? And yeah, so I think you're right. I think that if she was a scholar in the subject, which, you know, so few of us really are in the first place, I think she still would have made the choice to go over there and do whatever small act that she could of service to help to help, especially the children, but to help these people who were suffering.
Well, one of the things I think, not only for her family, but I think in seeing the play and in listening to her words and the script of the play and you bring that to life, one of the things that happens is people, I think, who don't normally have all that clear of an understanding of who the Palestinian people are, walk away with a much deeper understanding. And I think that's one of the things she brought to it, was a recognition of the humanity of the Palestinian people and insisting that others recognize it and demanding that they be treated with full human dignity.
Absolutely. And our hope, too, is that, you know, we're not trying to take sides or to sway opinion. But what you just said is so important. If there's one person who comes out of that production, out of that audience, and goes home and Googles, you know, the Gaza Strip so that they can even locate it on a map. I mean, there are so many of us, especially young people, and more as I dive into this experience and I'm really, you know, kind of rolling around in how it feels to be Rachel Corrie and the reactions that we're getting. Young people especially, I think, can really be affected by this play because she was a young woman and she had that invigorating energy and the enthusiasm that, you know, comes when you're 20 years old. And I hope that there's even one person who goes out and learns more about the subject, whether they say, oh, pro-Palestine, or whatever, it doesn't matter. That doesn't matter to us. It's educating themselves, and it's stepping out of the protective shield that so many of us have as just being these privileged Americans. So that's my hope.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Samara Frahm, who's the lead character, the only character in My Name is Rachel Corrie. She plays Rachel Corrie and does a damn good job of it. Really
Thank
good.
You.
A very powerful play. Now, and speaking about the power of this play, why don't you give people a little sense of what it's like? You know, I know you came prepared to actually read an excerpt from the play. So why don't you tell people, set it up, tell people what it is they're going to be listening to?
Okay, so the piece we're going to do, she'll actually set it up for you, but she's just arrived in Gaza, and so it's really her just reflecting. And again, it's her as an observer, as a poet and an observer. February 7th. I have been in Palestine for 2 weeks and 1 hour now, and I still have very few words to describe what I see. I don't know if many of the children here have ever existed without tank shell holes in their walls. I think even the smallest of these children understand that life is not like this everywhere. They love to get me to practice my limited Arabic. Today I tried to learn to say, Bush is a tool. But I don't think it translated quite right. Anyway, there are 8-year-olds here more aware of the workings of the global power structure than I was just a few years ago, at least regarding Israel. Nothing could have prepared me for the reality of the situation here. You just can't imagine it unless you see it. And even then, your experience is not at all the reality. What with the difficulties the Israeli army would face if they shot an unarmed U.S. citizen, the fact that I have money to buy water when the army destroys the wells, and of course the fact that I have the option of leaving. I am allowed to see the ocean. If I feel outrage at entering briefly into the world in which these children live, I wonder how it would be for them to arrive in my world. Once you have seen the ocean, lived in a silent place where water is taken for granted and not stolen in the night by bulldozers, spent an evening where you didn't wonder if the walls of your house might suddenly fall inward, aren't surrounded by towers and tanks and now a giant metal wall, I wonder if you can forgive the world for all the years spent existing, just existing, in resistance to the constant attempt to erase you from your home. That is something I wonder about these children. I wonder what would happen if they really knew. I am in Rafah, a city of 140,000 people, 60% of whom are refugees, many twice or three times over. Currently, the Israeli army is building a 12-meter-high wall between Rafah and the border. 602 homes have been completely bulldozed, and the number partially destroyed is much greater. Today, as I walked on top of the rubble, Egyptian soldiers called to me from the other side of the border, "Go back! Go back!" because a tank was coming, and then waving, and, "What's your name?" Something strangely disturbing about this friendly curiosity. To some degree, we are all kids, curious about other kids. Egyptian kids shouting at strange women wandering into the path of tanks. Palestinian kids shot from the tanks when they peeked out from behind a wall to see what was going on. International kids standing in front of the tanks with banners. Israeli kids in the tanks. occasionally shouting, occasionally waving. Many forced to be here, many just aggressive, anonymously shooting into the houses as we wander away. In addition to tanks, there are more IDF towers than I can count. Some just in army green metal, others these strange spiral staircases draped in some kind of netting. A new one went up the other day in the time it took us to do laundry and cross town twice to hang banners. And nowhere invulnerable to the Apache helicopters or the cameras of invisible drones we hear buzzing over the city for hours at a time. We've been wavering between 5 and 6 of us internationals. There are requests for constant nighttime presence at a well on the outskirts of Rafah since the 2 largest wells were destroyed last week. But after about 10 p.m., it is very difficult to move because the Israeli army treats anyone in the streets as resistance and shoots at them. So clearly we are too few. I am just beginning to learn from what I expect to be a very intense tutelage in the ability of people to organize against all odds and to resist against all odds.
Wow. Just a remarkable, remarkable performance. And you really bring her character to life. One of the things I wanted to ask you is you had to sort of immerse yourself in all of the writings of Rachel. You really must have come to know her very intimately. What were the things, a couple of the things that really grabbed you the most about Rachel Corey?
Well, I have the privilege. There's a book that was published called Let Me Stand Alone, and it was a compilation of many more of her journal entries and diaries than what you see in the play. So just sort of soaking that in and reading and seeing her sketches, I really came to realize that she's just a person with flaws. And, you know, there were moments that I would read some of the stuff that she would write on, and she wasn't very likable to me. But then I realized that she's a girl, right? Like, we could be friends. She's 2 years younger than I am. And we grew up in that same kind of era. And she was flawed like any of us are. And she spends a lot of time talking about guys and talking about school and learning. I think what I'm taking away from her as a human is her complexity. This is the first character that I've ever had who is as complex as she is. And I wonder if it's because she's, you know, a real human being and I had all the journals to really sink into, or if it's that she herself had that to her, which of course she did. But I'm taking away, I think, her hopefulness and her curiosity and her desire to observe. She was an observer, and that's really reflected in her poetry and in the lists that she made. Her list were everything from, you know, my list of things to do today to random stream of consciousness poetry that would rattle off everything from God to Mel Gibson to, you know, weapons of mass destruction to cereal. And so she just observed, and I love that about her. She often didn't put an agenda. She just wrote lists, pages and pages of literally what she saw. And I love that. She was curious and she was brave and she was hopeful. And I think those 3 things together make for a really complete human being who's ready to go dive in and say, what world, what can I do?
Mm-hmm. And let me ask you this, because one of the things I think must have been very difficult is that, you know, it seemed to me anyway, you're dealing with a character, like you said, who's everything that you said. You have her words. And so there's a certain amount of, you've got to hew to those words. You've got to actually stay there, because even though it's a play and it's a work of art, there's a reality to who she was and what she was saying, and it's built around that. At the same time, you're playing a character, you're bringing to life a character who, you know, is on a trajectory towards death, you know, and how you do that, and including in terms of how she's making that decision to take that point where epistemology meets morality, where what you know means you've got to do something, you know, you've got to act one way or the other. How hard was that to do?
Great question. I think my focus has always been that this is a play about her life, not about her death. And even in the last moment of the play, she doesn't think she's going to die. She's going to go eat peas with some strange people who are being generous and offering her a meal. You know, it's a play about her spirit and about her life and about those little things that change our lives, the little decisions that are made, the little observations. She, you know, at one point she says, the salmon talked me into a lifestyle change. You know, this random experience that she had learning about salmon and all those little stair steps. And that first half of the play is so exuberant. And we get to just sit back and watch this young woman, and she's just a kid living in Olympia, hanging out with her friends, you know, strutting around for her ex-boyfriend. And then the growth is that she shifts and she becomes more grounded and more, she realizes that there's a bigger picture than what she's ever experienced. It's about her life. So in that sense, it's simple. It's so easy.
And on that note, I think that's where we're going to stop. I think it's really an incredible play. And I think – although, actually, I'll ask you one thing. In 1 minute, you can do one more.
Great.
What will you take away from this play? I know whenever I'm involved in anything, I take something away that lasts forever. What will you take?
Storytelling and the power of story and the power of – not necessarily for me one particular cause or any of that, but just the ability of one woman's story to affect change. And that's what she's doing, I really hope, and I think she will continue.
And the impact that that definitely had in the world. You know, and I think one of the things – this came from an article that was written when the play was first being performed in New York, and it was in the Temp. They actually did stop it at a certain point. And this was an article from Revolution Newspaper, and that article said, one of the things to learn about from Rachel Corrie from the play is that people can also learn to resist, and courageous individuals can affect history. Everyone will be put to the test under the circumstances rarely of one's own choosing, and sometimes people will be called upon to act heroically when they are not fully prepared. That's the most important thing to learn from Rachel's life. I think that's, for me, something extremely important. So thank you very much, Samar.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. And I want to say this is something from me, and I want to make sure that people understand that. And I want to say that thinking about all this week, I thought of this quote from Bob Avakian that I really wanted to bring out to people. And that is, next to the Holocaust, the worst thing that has happened to Jewish people is the state of Israel. Think about that. When you want to argue with me about it, call me up, write to me, argue with me about it. But it's truth. And when you know something is true, you do have to act on that. That's where epistemology meets morality. I want to thank my board up for today. Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of my guests and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, and we're going out now with Masters of Deception from Ghetto Priest. Talk to you again next week.
The day the mirror cracked.